Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, artists, and publishers that make up and inspire the 1888 family. 1888 serves as a regional catalyst for the preservation, presentation, and promotion of cultural heritage and literary arts. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How, the Why, brought to you by 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Jonathan Eller, the director for the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies and a senior textual editor for the Institute of American Thought at Indiana University. John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
It's my pleasure.
So, let's talk a little bit about, you've written two books as well. I didn't mention that in your intro. You wrote Becoming Ray Bradbury and Ray Bradbury Unbound, two different biographies on different parts of his life. But what was it initially? Was it reading him as a child? What was it that drew you to Ray?
Well, it's an interesting arc of experience, and it's probably not terribly uncommon in America. He had this seven-decade career from the very early 1940s, literally up until 2012. His last essay, Reminiscence, was published in The New Yorker the day before he died in June of 2012. So you have this seven-decade arc, and he's influenced, probably four or five generations of readers. For me, it started in the early 1960s, around 1962, 63, when I discovered his 1953 collection, The Golden Apples of the Sun. That was the magic entry for me, stories that became very famous, and we can talk about a few of them at some point if you'd like, but from there, I quickly got into The Martian Chronicles and The Illustrated Man, two of his earliest books that really established his reputation, and eventually Fahrenheit, which of course became one of his most famous books by the later decades of the 20th century because of the issues it talks about, basically freedom of the imagination and freedom from censorship. I really had a really great piece of fortune in meeting him in the late 1980s, hosting him for a week at a wonderful conference at the Air Force Academy in Colorado, where I was teaching at the time, and two of my colleagues sponsored a science fiction convention, a really, really nice panel session. And Ray was ours to take care of for a week, and that's where we really hit it off, and I had such a wonderful time learning from him, learning from this man whom I had read as a young child and as a young man, a little more about him and his career. I stayed in touch, and by the mid-90s, I was working with other editors on editions of his work, limited editions, and beginning in the later 90s, for the last 15 years of his life, I started visiting and working on these books. And I co-authored in 2004 an earlier Bradbury book called Ray Bradbury, The Life of Fiction, which was really the first university press book that any academic press had done on him at the time. My co-author, Bill Tuponce, and I both taught here at the Indianapolis campus of Indiana University, IUPUI as it's known. And by 2007, we had set up the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies. So it's been around for almost 9 years now. We started out, Bill established the editions that I still edit today. He's retired now, but we set up an edition of the collected stories of Ray Bradbury. It's one of our missions here, is to bring back the earliest versions of his oldest stories from the early and mid and late 1940s and publish them in scholarly editions. We also publish a journal, the New Ray Bradbury Review, And this and my visits out there with him in the springtime and fall often led to the writing of the two books, Becoming Ray Bradbury, which covers the first 33 years of his life up to the point in 1953 where he wrote Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury Unbound, which covers the middle years of his life up to about 1970 when he becomes the primary visionary and lay spokesman for the space age. And I'm beginning work now on the third and final volume, which will cover the final decades of his life. So there's my arc with Ray Bradbury, and it's been a rewarding life, I can tell you.
Now, when you started in 2007, the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies, what were you hoping that would become? I mean, it's turned into almost a museum of sorts. But what were you hoping to create back then?
Well, at that point, we had this energy base of Bill and I. Bill had done his dissertation back in the early 1980s on Ray and had done a couple of pioneering monographs on Ray's work in the late 80s and early 90s. And I had the momentum with the personal relationship and the historical biographical things I was doing. And so when we set it up, the School of Liberal Arts here, which is our home unit, set it up as a research center where we could begin to work on projects like the collective story. So it was pretty much just Bill's books and my books and things that Ray's good friend and principal bibliographer, Don Albright, would give us, and occasionally things that Ray would give us during my trips out there for the center. But we were primarily basically research scholarly, and our goal was to show his broader impact across American culture, because he was such a cultural icon. He worked so deeply in Hollywood, literature, art, his books, his stories fill 1,000, not they don't fill them, but they're represented in over 1,000 textbooks and anthologies. And he was such an inspirational figure in planetary science, in aerospace work, and in cosmology. So many scientists and engineers and astronauts were inspired by his work. And we wanted to initially work with preserving that legacy for him in the world, and at the same time to bring him more prominently into academics. Everyone reads Ray Bradbury in junior high and high school, not studied so much in college, although we do see significant study of him in college. But scholars weren't writing a lot of books about him. Scholars considered him more of a popular cultural figure and a genre writer, whereas in reality, he rarely obeyed genre rules. His stories were very unique and richly poetic, metaphorical stories that really transcended the high and popular cultural boundaries quite a bit. And we wanted to foreground his legacy for academics, but also for general readers, how important he was across the culture in terms of freedom of the imagination, championing literacy, preserving libraries, and then promoting the space program. And then by 2012, after he passed away, his family and his good friend Don Albright together gave us the gifts of his office, his working library, his many of his papers, about 100,000 pages of his papers that he still had in the house in his later years, and the last 40 years of his life correspondence with other writers and figures. The furniture of his office will allow us to rebuild his office as it was in his home for many years, that magical space where he would get ideas to write his stories. So we transitioned over these 9 years from being a research organization promoting his legacy and keeping that alive and extending it into the academic world, into really an exhibition and museum area, an archival place with a lot of original material. So that's been what we've done as the center has progressed.
Now, the center is part of the Institute for American Thought. Tell our listeners a little bit about that, which is like a little grander, one step beyond what you're doing with the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies.
You know, it's a nice fit for us. It does show that overarching umbrella in American culture and American ideas here. But like so many things, it was a matter of good fortune. The reason we have Ray Bradbury's part of his legacy, which we share and will always share with Los Angeles, which was his creative home for so much of his life, but we've also, you know, been able to bring him a part of his legacy back here to his Midwestern roots, where he was born, just across the border in Illinois, and so that was sort of an accident of fortune that we were here to do that. The same thing with the Institute for American Thought, which overarches us. So many times, scholars work on individual authors on their own, just linked to other scholars at other universities who will work with them occasionally long distance. What we have here is a unique opportunity where we have full-time staff, resident staff, who work with the authors who ended up represented here in the Institute for American Thought. And again, it was a case of good fortune. I brought the Bradbury work here, but long before that, the other scholars in the philosophy department had brought the collected works of the American scientist and philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce here back in the 1970s. He was the father of pragmatism. He was an important figure in semiotics, and he was a 19th century sort of a man ahead of his time. So he's fully studied and published here in the Institute. We also then have better known figures like the works of George Santayana, the American philosopher and literary figure George Santayana, who actually was Spanish, but so much of his life was spent in America. So we have the works of George Santayana, and then we have the Frederick Douglass papers here. They moved with the project director through various universities and ended up here. So for about the last 15 years, the energy has sort of centered on having staffs using some original materials, but most of the other editions use all source materials, sort of a virtual archive online, gathered from many research centers around the country and around the world, to write on and do commentary on and publish the works of these sort of eclectic figures, often interdisciplinary figures, George Santayana, Frederick Douglass, Charles Peirce, and for the last 9 years, Ray Bradbury. So sometimes good fortune and the accidents of academic life allow a place like the Institute for American Thought to start up.
Now, as it's progressing and growing and changing, is it a place that people will come and regularly visit and experience and look at the desk where Ray wrote and once you build that office, is that what you're hoping to create, kind of a museum of sorts?
Yes, and that's the wonderful nature of this work, and the good fortune of having these gifts here and the trust of so many people who brought things here, allowed us to bring things here. The Peirce, Santayana, and Douglass papers projects work primarily with digital images and photocopies from all over the world, so it's a nice research center for each of those projects. For us, it's you're absolutely right. We're growing into a much more of a public outreach destination, where we will be able to have a more public expanded center, where we will have both a museum and an exhibition area set up. We practiced for that last August when, for a month, we set up Ray's desk and a number of his artifacts, books, representative manuscripts, and art from all the great magazines that were associated with his stories and novels from mid-century America on. we put all that representative pieces of what we have in a gallery show, the centerpiece being his desk, and under glass having his desk as it was late in his life. We brought in more visitors during that than the cultural arts gallery on our campus had seen in a long time, and that was in an off month. That was in August. Every year we intend to do the same in October, which is sort of a Ray Bradbury month with his story collections like the October Country. This year in October we'll have another show. But the most exciting development right now, we've been in a very small footprint on campus. As far as a research center, only seats about six people, and then a large storeroom, which holds much of the legacy that we were gifted from Ray Bradbury's materials, has been in storage since we were able to bring it here in 2013. That's all changing. This summer, we will move into a much larger space that will continue to grow around the core area we'll be given this summer, to have exactly what you mentioned, the kind of location that students, faculty, the general public from Central Indiana, and frankly, if our early visitors are any indication, people from all around the country and overseas, if they have a chance to come to Indianapolis, will be able to come into a large gallery and exhibition area within the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies. And at the center of all that, next to our archival areas, will be a recreation, about a 720-square-foot recreation of his home office.
Hmm. Now, in your meetings while you were working on the biographies, when you met with the man, was he aware of the cultural significance, obviously later in life, but was there ever a sense of how aware he was of how significant and important his writings were at the time of the writing, or was he just trying to tell stories?
You know, that's interesting because, again, that's such a remarkable arc. When he started out, of course, he had nothing. Here he was, a boy born in 1920. 1938, he graduates. They've moved west, and he graduates from Los Angeles High School. And he didn't go to college. He never went to college a day in his life. He sold newspapers on a street corner in Los Angeles weekday afternoons to make a single penny off of every 3-cent newspaper he sold. And by 1942, he knew he wanted to write. He had been from 1938 to 1942 writing and learning to write and writing amateur pieces. And by 41 and 42, he was becoming a professional writer. But he still had no idea how far it was going to go. He said to me once, he said, "Look in the Los Angeles High School Annual. They asked me for 3 quotes about myself, and in the last quote I said, headed for literary distinction."
Hmm.
"I wasn't headed anywhere. I couldn't do anything. But my ego had to believe that maybe I would be headed somewhere. And it finally happened." So it's very mysterious. Very mysterious. End of quote. Now looking at the other end, which is really the heart of your question, how did he assimilate fame and how did that work? Well, you know, he was well known as a writer in genre fields and even in the big market magazines before 1950. But 1950 with the Martian Chronicles, there's the foundational book for the next 40 years. That would be really the book where you start to think about, will we go to another planet? Will we make the same mistakes we made on this planet? And so, you know, there's fame comes from that. Fahrenheit. So many story collections like The Illustrated Man, The October Country, all those dark fantasy stories with that Ray Bradbury twist, novels like Something Wicked This Way Comes. And by the late 50s and earlier even, and through the 60s and 70s, he's taken that to Hollywood. And so many things are appearing on from the 50s on in Alfred Hitchcock Presents and on the Twilight Zone, once in the first series and once in the second series of Twilight Zones. and then motion pictures, probably a dozen or more motion picture projects related to his work were eventually made, some with his work and assistance and others without. But, you know, how did he handle the fame? The fame pulled him away from writing short stories, and in Ray Bradbury Unbound, I had to chronicle that, how by the late 60s, he's only writing three, four stories throughout the 60s, maybe three or four stories a year. The guy who had written and published dozens of stories a year was being pulled away into Hollywood, into name recognition, into space program events, Hollywood events. And the way he fought off being a victim of fame. And then here's another thought on that, which he said to me in 2002. He said, "One of the reasons for my success is I've never wanted to be famous. I've just wanted to be loved."
Hmm.
There's a difference. A difference. You find that a book like Fahrenheit is in every library in the country and most of the schools, but I didn't intend that. That wasn't the reason. I wrote it because it was a great idea, and I loved the idea. That's what he focused on, that kind of very simple, very fundamental desire, I think is one of the things that saved him from becoming a victim of the fame that was his by really for the last 50 years of his career.
There's a lot of social, political weight to his stories. Was he somebody that felt like this is a message that needs to get across? Or again, was it just like, I'm writing these stories and these are underpinnings of the stories?
He, you know, he knew that not every story he wrote was a great story. There were times, especially later in his career, when he maybe waxed a little too nostalgic, maybe a little too sentimental. That's why the real edgy stories, the stories with that Bradbury twist, are really from the 40s and 50s and into the 1960s. And he felt that kind of story writing was a gift. It was a gift that it was almost a God-given gift in a way, he always felt. And he would say, he said to me once, there's the Ray Bradbury that writes and the me that watches him. I can't believe that there are two of me, and I'm the witness now to what I did before. And I think I'm so lucky that God made me in two halves, the creator and the witness. And his sense of being both a creator and a witness accelerated down through his life. At the same time, what you're asking about, his controversial stance on some things, his plain-spoken ideas about, for instance, McCarthyism in the 1950s and the threat to freedom of the imagination. He was very outspoken when McCarthy was at his height. He wrote a national letter to the Republican Party after the 52 convention that was picked up eventually in The Nation. And like Edward R. Murrow, he was, you know, questioning McCarthy at a time when a lot of writers felt they couldn't afford to do it, especially those who were locked into Hollywood. Ray had a broader fan base, and he felt he could take that risk. And so he would come out against those who were intolerant or would say that intolerance does not exist. He hated tyrannies of the left. He hated tyrannies of the right, and he would be outspoken. By the 60s, he had always been anti-war in the sense that he didn't see that wars based on purely political ambitions should be tolerated, and he really was critical of those who would divert things away from the space program at a crucial time when it was just evolving and beginning to set foot on other planets. He said the night Apollo 11, the landing, and when he was in England, London, England at the time, when his interview with Mike Wallace was then taped and played the next day through Walter Cronkite's broadcasts out of the NASA Space Flight Center in Texas, Bradbury said, men and boys love to play at war, and they love war. But the real war is the war of going and taking mankind to outer space. The cosmos, I believe he said, the cosmos doesn't give a fig for us, doesn't care what we are or if we live and die. That's what we must fight. We care. We care if we live and die as a culture, as humanity. That's the war to fight, is the war to take us against a hostile cosmos, overcome the odds, and take mankind and the best part of our ideas and inspirations and aspirations into outer space.
Ah, that's amazing. I'm going to finish with one thing. I know you guys are, like you said, you're recreating his office, his creative space. And with 1888 and with this podcast and other programs that we do, we like focusing on the routines of creative people. So, you know, finding out what it is that you need surrounding you as you're writing, as you're creating your work, as you're editing or painting or whatever it is that you do. So you actually would be the best person to kind of paint a picture of what his creative space looked like, what his desk would look like, and what he had around him as he would work.
Well, he was a very visual creative genius, self-taught in many ways. And so he probably saw every film made up into the 1950s, and he was very visually oriented. So he would keep in his office and begin to acquire as inspirations all kinds of things of the imagination. You'd see skeletons in his house. You'd see The Jar from his short story The Jar, which was broadcast on the Alfred Hitchcock Presents show in the mid-1950s, the 1963. The Jar, the story about everybody sees something different in the jar. Well, he still had that Hitchcock TV prop in his office all through his life, and we have it here now to preserve it in the recreation of the office. He had these things around because they fed into his sense of tapping into his subconscious mind. He felt that's where it all begins, and he would word associate. That's why so many of his stories have titles like The Lake, The Veld, The Martian, The Illustrated Man, because he would word associate, and then he would look around him and see which ones what things in his office would sort of energize various word associations. And then he would sort of work from whatever the subconscious threw out for him, and he would then write a story, let the characters run away with it, just write and write and write without being self-conscious. And after a few hours, if he were lucky, and this would happen more often than not, he'd have sort of a perfectly formed little 3,000 to 5,000 word story. He would keep his conscious mind from interfering until the revision process. And he really didn't like revision that much, but he made it sort of a deal with his subconscious that just to let it well up these ideas and let the characters run away in the keys on his typewriters. That was sort of his process, the way he liked to write.
Now give me a little of what your creative space looks like in comparison.
Well, it's funny. It's changed over time. I spent 20 years in the military, and that's when I met Ray in the 1980s. I was still a professor at the Air Force Academy, and then now I've spent almost a quarter of a century in academia here. And although I have sort of an eclectic office, it's starting to become more of a space. I'm trained in world literature and American literature, but I've got a lot of science fiction and fantasy, early editions, the same editions that Ray would have read, of some of his loves, Edgar Rice Burroughs, H. Rider Haggard, people like that. I've got, two of the walls I have pictures of my friends and Ray and me at various times down through the years. That's an inspirational kind of place. And my office is a bit cluttered because that's also a sign of a healthy creative mind. His office was often very cluttered, as you'll see after we recreated or in any of the pictures you can find in media today. And so I almost had to in writing the books, follow my way through his creative learning, the books he read. And it was almost like being a kid and a young man all over again. And my office sort of reflects that double life today.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. It was a very informative and sort of excited about all the work you're doing, and hope I'll make my way to the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at some point and be able to see that recreation of the office. I mean, it's a shame we lost his home last year. I remember hearing a interview about the demolition of his place in Cheviot Hills, but you know, it'd be nice that there is that thing that people can go and pay their respects to.
Yes, and you know, none of us saw that coming. That was so unexpected. But as you say, there is so much love for him in Southern California, especially in Los Angeles, that I think that people will appreciate what we're trying to do out here, and others are trying to do in Waukegan, where he was born. That sort of forms a nice energy base along with Los Angeles, and we will keep him alive. And I'd love to see you out here, and anybody else you want to bring and visit us in the years ahead.
Thank you again.
This has been the How, the Why by 1888. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.